This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is brought to you by the Expert Institute. Check out Expert Institute's new cutting-edge feature, Expert Radar, where they track down background information about your own expert or the opposing expert, including their litigation activity, any times they've been challenged, speeches, articles, presentations, deposition transcripts, you name it. Just push the button and let them go to work tracking down all that information for you. Saves you time, and when they find information that is helpful to you, it can be a game changer for your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. Today's episode is also brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a digital marketing and web development firm specializing in helping the high end of the trial practice develop great websites, great digital marketing campaigns. Give them a call, talk to Tyler or Micah over there, see what they can do for you. Finally, today's episode is brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used by trial lawyers all over the country to help manage the docket of cases that you have in your practice. It allows you to do everything from templates to forms to work plans, saves time, makes your practice more profitable and efficient. Check them out at smartadvocate.com.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
And I'm Ben Gideon.
Ben, how are you?
I'm doing well. So Rahul, since the last time we recorded, you brought your family on a well-deserved trip to Ireland. Did you guys have a good time?
Oh, we had a great time. It's actually pretty cold over there. But other than that, it is such a beautiful country and a wonderful experience for the kids. Coolest thing we did, though, is falconry, where hawks were landing on our arms and stuff. And my 10-year-old kid, he was really taken to it. So it was a lot of fun. Equally important, though, Ben, I heard there's some significant news out in Maine. Do you have a trial date?
Miracles do happen. Yes, they're starting to schedule jury trials again in my state. We were scheduled for a malpractice trial. Unfortunately, it is not until January of 2023, which means that our state will have gone approximately 3 years without conducting any significant civil trials. But things are starting to move in the right direction. We're actually hoping to get another case scheduled over the summer. And a part of that is the guest we have today, Judge Williams. Welcome to the podcast. I actually met Judge Williams as part of a committee I was working on with the state, and including some of our active judges on our Supreme Court and our Superior Court. And Judge Williams was kind enough to come and meet with us by Zoom and to help us figure out how to navigate getting up and running with remote trials. So we're going to talk about that today. But before we do, Judge Williams, I was looking back at your bio. You have a pretty interesting background, but my favorite part of it was, and I'm reading from your biography, says, when not presiding over the bench, Judge Williams spends his time working on rule of law in emerging democracies such as Central Asia, South America, Africa, and Middle East, former Soviet republics. Also holds the rank of black belt in Taekwondo and sits as a pilot in command throughout the United States. So pretty interesting stuff and fairly timely given what's going on in the world today. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
You know, each of us has to pay our rent on the planet, you know, and each of us finds the way to do that. It's over the course of my career, I've been given the opportunity to be able to, well, provide, you know, learn, but also provide some, be kind of a conduit of information between different countries on how they handle justice systems, how the rule of law can be applied, when different types of technologies or ways of doing things, not necessarily technology in an electronic sense, but different types of techniques, how they can be used in culturally specific ways to improve justice systems, and been able to be kind of a conduit for that between different nations, and try to bring some of that back into our practice here, because there's so much that we can learn within our justice system as well.
I should have mentioned that you are a Superior Court judge in Kings County, Washington State, correct?
Kings County is in New York. King County, as in Martin Luther, is here. We're the greater Seattle region. Interesting enough, Seattle is less than a fifth of the population of King County. King County has a population that is slightly larger than the combined populations of Maine and Montana. It has, it's just slightly larger than the state of Delaware. That's just the county.
Wow. So you guys were really an early adopter of remote jury selection and remote trials. Can you tell us a little bit about how you came to that and kind of the systems that and the technology that was required to make that work?
Sure. And, you know, candidly, it was not nearly as complex as most people think it might have been. But like all innovation, it came from basically desperation. We were in a situation, just as many courts are, and you describe what's going on in Maine, where the justice system was sort of grinding to a halt because people could not be physically in the same space. And so we started trying to figure out ways that we could do things virtually. And that began as simple as essentially taking hearings and moving them into kind of a conference call environment. But I don't know if you're familiar with that movie, Real Genius, where there's that one scene where he walks into the room and there's all these tape recorders, but not even the professors there. At one point, that was how our courts were having to function. The courtroom doors are unlocked, or rather were locked. The courtroom itself was dark, but the recording system was on and everybody had dialed in and there was a conference call going on. And so it started that simply. And then it kind of grew from there as we tried to figure out solutions to move past just having hearings so we could keep both the criminal and the civil justice system going. And then Judge Marsha Peckman, who is a federal judge here in the Western District of Washington, as pandemic progressed, she essentially said, we're having a trial and it will be a fully virtual trial. Now, we had already worked, the King County Superior Court had already worked with our local bar and with other stakeholders to try to figure out ways that we could move more and more things into a virtual Zoom or Cisco or WebEx environment. But it was Judge Peckman who just said, yeah, okay, to the lawyers who were, no, you can't do that. She essentially said, no, we're doing this. And they did it. And it worked. And the lawyers that tried that case now are some of the most prolific advocates for virtual trials. And that really broke the ice. We, in turn, used her experience, the manual that she built, a Zoom manual that was built by our colleagues just to the south in Pierce County. And we just kept building upon that. We did the very first virtual voir dire in a criminal case. It went as smoothly as you could expect for the first time of anything. And Judge Roger Rogoff, he made the comment to me, said, yeah, you just get started. You do it, you run into a problem, you solve the problem, you move on to the next problem. And that's really been kind of the mantra is this, you just got to get it done. You take a step forward, you run into a problem, you solve the problem, you share that with the rest of the bench, and we just keep moving forward.
What were some of the problems that you encountered early on, and how were the solutions developed?
Well, you know, one of the biggest problems is attitudinal, because of course, like most of us, I spent my life as a trial lawyer in the well, and our entire 200 plus year history of trial and of the adversarial system, it is of in-person advocacy. So the idea that we could have effective remote advocacy is completely alien. And frankly, yes, there is a generational component to that, but it's a very different kind of interaction. So the first challenge we had was attitudinal. And then, of course, there were the technical barriers. Well, okay, how do you make sure that everyone has access? How do you make sure that no one is excluded if they don't have access? And so as we work through those challenges, and we realized that preparation was crucial, the technology was the platform, but technology was not always necessarily the solution. Our first fully virtual jury trials were done from the bench perspective with nothing more than a judge with a laptop and a webcam pointing at the judge, and another monitor, another computer set up in the courtroom so that anybody that came into that open courtroom could observe the proceedings. It was that simple. Now, since then, we've evolved some more sophisticated technology, especially for courtroom display. But at the end of the day, the technology is not the hard part. The hard part is figuring out the manual processes to make and the preparation for the trial to make sure that things like exhibit flow go well, to make sure that the lawyers know that this is not, you're not just going to take your charismatic courtroom presentation and bring it into the courtroom, because you're dealing with a media in which everyone is looking directly at everyone's faces. And so there were some, I guess you could call it sort of manual process workarounds that we had to make sure that not only the court, but also that the lawyers were tuned into to make sure that it worked.
Can you talk about that issue of access? Because that's one thing we've heard raised in our state, which is that particularly for a poor rural state, there's concern that if you move to remote jury selection or trial, that there will be some jurors that are priced out of that because they don't have good quality Wi-Fi at home or they don't have a device. We always point out that the contrary is true. If you have as well, that if you have to drive 2 hours and you don't have a good quality vehicle, you can't take the time to drive to the courtroom, you're also priced out of it if you do it in person. But where have you seen that balance struck? And what are you getting for response rates to jury summonses through virtual versus in person?
Okay, let's kind of break that down. And probably the first key principle is it's not this or that. You don't have to pick purely everybody has to show up remotely. You can have a situation where you have a limited number of jurors. Because remember, during pandemic, the key was to keep large groups of people from coming together. So you can, if there is a group of people that say, you know what, either I'm not comfortable with remote access, I can't afford, I don't have reliable Wi-Fi or bandwidth. Well, the solution, which is the traditional solution, is, well, you allow that limited group of people in small groups to come into the courthouse. I just finished a murder one trial in which I had three jurors who did not have, because King County is huge and we have people that live in very remote areas where, and because of the mountains, you don't necessarily have particularly great cell bandwidth. And so those individuals, they said, you know, I can't really do this, which we said, you know what, tell you what, you can, we will provide you with, I actually have two refurbished iPads, come down to the courthouse, we have Wi-Fi. They actually sat out in conference rooms, each of them in their own personal space, while we did jury selection with them, literally just out in the hallway. So part of it is just to recognize you don't have to do all or nothing. You can blend into your solutions whatever works. Sometimes we're just kind of kicking it in with our knees, you know? And so part of that is just understanding that the key is access. But your point about access for, in terms of, you know, candidly, more people have cell phones, smartphones, than have automobiles. And a smartphone and is more, well, it's more affordable than an automobile and frankly, even than a bus pass. And especially during these times when people are sort of reluctant to travel, what we found was is our response rates to jury summonses jumped dramatically. And this is a little bit apples and oranges because of the way the process works. But to give you an example, and again, in this last trial, I had a veneer of just over 250. And we send a pre-questionnaire to the veneer. I had a 97% response rate within 72 hours. Now, you contrast that with, you know, standard response rates to you send a summons and you get significantly higher. And part of that's because, and when I interviewed the jury that we just finished this trial, and one of the consistent themes was, I can afford to do this because I don't have to come down to the courthouse and sit around for 2 days waiting for the judge and the lawyers to call me into court, and then sitting there with 50 other people while they ask questions of other people. Instead, I'm in a group of 20 people. I have a 90-minute block that I can block out of my life. I can make sure that I'm in a place where I feel safe and secure. And the other comment that I got from this juror, but I've seen it from many jurors, is that they find that the quality of the interaction between them and the attorneys during remote voir dire is greater. They're paid more attention to. There's more flow of information from the jurors to the lawyers. And that's completely counterintuitive to those of us that spent our lives in the well, where we're used to that in-person interaction, that and have being able to have that in-person bond with the jurors. What our jurors find was, A, the fact that they don't have to pull themselves out of work, out of their lives, for multiple days just to go through the process of voir dire means it's easier for them to participate. But also, they feel safer and they feel like they can relate to and communicate better with the attorneys in this environment. The effect of that, in turn, has been that we've seen, and this is anecdotal, although there are currently two different studies going on that we expect, we've got preliminary results that validate this anecdotal experience. Certainly, it's been my experience. Far, both ethnically, economically, and racially diverse veneers and juries, because people can afford to come and participate in the process. It's more accessible. Key to that, though, goes back to your first question, which is, what do you do to make sure that nobody gets excluded? Well, what you do is you say, well, okay, if you can't participate in this way because we're giving you additional access, then we'll return back to, we'll figure out ways that would be similar to what we traditionally would do.
Can you explain how you do jury selection? So you get 250 prospective jurors for a murder one trial. I'm assuming they're not all logging on at the same time. So can you just explain how the logistics of that?
Sure. Now, to do that, I need to drop in professor mode and talk a little bit about the different styles of jury selection that are used around the country. I'm one of the few, because I'm old enough, I'm one of the few lawyers that ever actually picked a jury using the old strike and replace method, which is still used in some parts of the country. And that's where you talk to juror number one and only juror number one until you then make a decision. Exercise challenge for cause, exercise of prep. And then when you're done with that juror, they're either accepted or they're excused. Then you go to juror number two and you start the process over. For generations, that was how juries were selected. But now, of course, structuring method, what some people call the Donahue or the Oprah method, that's really because it's more efficient. It's more, you can pick a jury in about two and a half hours because you get 50 people or 200 people in a room, and then the lawyers have a block of time that they can question everyone. Again, the quality of that interaction, it becomes more of a charismatic exercise of the lawyer rather than a flow of information from the jurors to the lawyer. But that is currently the more generally used methodology. But there's one in the middle, and it's called the sequential method. And we wind up using it because I can only fit about 50 people into this courtroom, even if it's packed. And so if I have a large veneer, and as an example, in this case, there was 250 because of the nature of the case. Normally, it'd be about between 50 and 80. That would mean that even in pre-pandemic days, I would have to do panels. And for those that have never experienced anything other than struct method, that seems completely alien because you're essentially taking these panels in sequence, which means that the experience that the jurors have is not in voir dire is not necessarily exactly the same. But bear in mind, that's how it used to work. And so what we do is we take panels, usually of about between 12 to 20, because that's what fits comfortably on a computer screen. And we'll break it down into panels. And each panel is about 90 minutes long. And the lawyers have I give the lawyers 2 minutes per juror, which is actually significantly more than they would have in the larger panel. And again, the quality of the interaction between the lawyers and the jurors becomes, well, you find the jurors and the lawyers getting to know each other much better, bonding better. The amount of information the jurors will share in this environment is stunning. And so it's process is this idea of panels of jurors that the lawyers will then will complete all of the panels. As an example, in this last case, there were 5 panels of jurors that we did. And we can talk about the differential in that number between 250 and 5 panels of 20 in a second. But then after that is over, after the jurors have been excused from each panel, then the lawyers in open court with me, we then go through a process where we go through the perimps. And we also, during that same hearing, will deal with what is called, you know, obviously Batson issues on each perimp. But here in Washington State, we also have GR 37. And GR 37 is essentially a codification, but it's sort of Batson on steroids. Again, what that does is that allows the lawyers to fully argue those issues outside the presence of the jury, to replicate the experience of the lawyers being able to sit there and kind of count and then look at the juror and be able to know, okay, that's the juror that I intend to strike. Part of what many of my colleagues do and what I do is we'll take a screenshot with the permission of the jurors. We'll take a screenshot of the jury panel so the lawyers have that in front of them as they're making their selections. That's it in a nutshell.
That's amazing. So transitioning into the actual trial itself, I've always heard from a number of naysaying lawyers who don't want virtual trials to work. That reference to that Texas trial where that juror fell asleep and they're saying, well, there's no control over the environment of the prospective jurors. From your experience, I know it works because we're talking here today, but what would be your response to those prospective lawyers and naysayers?
Well, the reality is the role of the judge in a virtual trial is different than the role of a judge in an in-person trial. And the judge has much greater responsibility to be monitoring the jurors. As during each of my trials, I am literally zooming in and I'm watching the eyes of the jurors. I'm watching as they may be typing or writing to make sure. And if I see that they're doing things that doesn't match what's going on, I will call them out. I also make a point during each voir dire panel of finding a juror that may not be seeming to be paying attention. And usually they are, but by doing that, they know I'm watching. And I advise them. I tell them I'm watching them. So the answer to that is that the judge has a much heightened responsibility. Because unlike the world where we walk into this grand building that has this the solemnity about it, here, the solemnity is created by the behavior of the judge. And the judge, and I enlist the aid of the attorneys to advise me and tell me if they think that someone's not paying attention. But it becomes the job of the judge to make sure that the jurors are focused. Now, if the judge is doing their job, and again, I'm expressing my personal belief, if the judge is doing their job and monitoring things, my experience has been, based upon what I see, have seen in in-person trials and have seen in remote trials, the jurors, weirdly enough, and this is totally counterintuitive, are more engaged. They can see better. They can see the micro expressions in the face. And I've had jurors use that expression. They can see the exhibits better. And I'll give you an example in the last completely virtual civil jury trial that I did, where 2 of the lawyers had that very experience that you described. They actually, in a prior case, they'd actually had to excuse 2 jurors that were not paying attention. In my case, what happened was, well, in civil cases here in Washington State, jurors have the right to submit questions after the examination of each witness. doesn't mean that questions get asked. They just have the right to submit them. And then the lawyers and the judge go over them and decide which questions to ask. And normally you'll get maybe two, three questions. After the testimony of the plaintiff, the jurors submitted 67 questions. I have never seen that level of engagement. And I got to tell you, you know, you're probably sitting there going, well, okay, that just means they weren't paying attention. No, actually, the lawyers, upon us reviewing them, we agreed that 59 of them should be asked because they were good questions. They were insightful questions because the jurors were engaged, were paying attention. I've never seen that level of attention before. But I think that that's in part attributable to three things. One, they can see the witnesses better. They can hear them better. They can see the exhibits better, and they can. And when the lawyers are skilled with being able to share a screen, then the points are made better, and the communication is better. But there's another thing that's going on, and again, it's completely counterintuitive. You see, when a juror is sitting here in the courtroom, they're in this alien environment. We get used to it because we work here, but they're in this alien, very distracting environment. They're worried, you know, where am I going to get lunch? How am I get home? Is my car safe? You know, am I going to be able to make my bus? They're worried about things, and they have a lot going on around them that they don't really understand. And there's a lot of activity going on around them. But when they're in a virtual trial, and again, completely intuitive, we require that they be in a space by themselves, free of distraction. And again, I'm monitoring them to make sure that they're not being distracted by the dog barking or anything like that. As a result, they don't have anything except this computer screen to focus on. So they're more focused. But a big part of that goes back to the judge. The judge has to be the one that sets the expectations, of solemnity, of seriousness, but also, and again, I was recently interviewed by a group of us here at the court were recently interviewed by NPR, and I was kind of called out as being, you know, kind of the meanie judge, but, you know, that's part of the job is you have to say, you know, juror number 13, I'm sorry, you appear to be doing something other than paying attention. And by the way, that happened in this last trial. No, judge, I'm just filing my nails. Turns out she was just filing her nails. She wound up serving. And I got to tell you, and again, in this last trial, incredibly focused jury. So there you have it.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno. Steno is a court reporting service offering court reporting all over the United States. The great feature of Steno, among others, is that they offer the ability to defer payment for court reporting services until the end of your case, which means you can enhance your cash flow as a plaintiff's lawyer since you're not getting paid until the case resolves, allowing you to the freedom to take as many depositions as you want and you need in order to prove your case. Check them out at steno.com. We're also sponsored today by Law Pods. Law Pods is a service that helps lawyers create podcasts like the very podcast you're listening to right now. Law Pods is our producer. All of the great content and production quality for the show, which is terrific, is done by Law Pods. If you have an idea for a podcast or just want to run something by them, check them out at lawpods.com. Give them a call and see what they can do to help you. Can you comment on what you've seen from lawyers that is effective in a remote trial that may be different from what you see in person? And I think in specifically about, we do some remote trials in our state. We have this pre-litigation screening panel and malpractice. We do all of those remote. And I've noticed in, for example, cross-examination, the flow seems to be a little bit different doing it remote versus in person. But I'm curious with your experience, what you've observed about the lawyering.
Well, there are three things about remote trials that lawyers have to be aware of because it requires a different level of preparation, but also stylistically it's different. And starting with the idea that when you're in a courtroom, you have this space. And we train advocates from the get-go to fill that space with their gravitas, with their personality. And to, well, again, just it becomes theater. Well, remote trials are not theater. It is less about extemporaneous and about filling a space, because remember, the space is now very small and contained. It is far more about substance and preparation. The other thing to remember about this environment is that when you're, as an example, if you have a witness that's being difficult on the witness stand, and when you are in a live courtroom, you're addressing your aggression. I'm going to use the word aggression for want of a better word. You're addressing your aggression and intensity at the witness. And the jury is kind of off to the side. So they're not experiencing it in the same way. But in a Zoom trial, in a remote trial, everybody's seeing the same thing. So when you're getting aggressive with the witness, you're getting aggressive with the jurors, and they don't like it. And so you have to remember that the visual is different. And the lawyers have to be able to control the entirety of that visual. They have to plan for it. A remote trial is not theater in the same of this extemporaneous event. It is very much television. It is tightly scripted, lots of thought, lots of preparation, up to and including what are you going to have in your background. The next thing you got to remember is how you're going to handle exhibits. And that requires advanced preparation, because exhibits are all going to be displayed remotely. They're going to be filed remotely. And so you can do things on the fly, but it's a little bit more difficult and you have to plan for it. And finally, and you sort of alluded to this, there's the issue of impeachment. Okay, well, how do you impeach a witness if you can't show them the document with which you're impeaching them on the screen, because the same screen is being used to show the jury? And he can't show the document to the jury. And once again, the answers to that is advanced planning. There's five ways of skinning that cat. We've actually produced a set of short videos for lawyers, kind of training, and here's how you get ready, which includes those five ways of dealing with this issue of how do you get this document in the witness's hand before the examination or during the examination without actually showing it to the jury. And so it just requires a little bit more thought. The key thing to remember is that the visual gives the lawyer is in far greater control of the visual of what the jurors see, but that means the lawyer has to be thoughtful about it and can't simply rely upon their past. Well, and most of us learn to try cases in kind of a charismatic way. And charisma is important, don't get me wrong. It comes across in a different way, and you have to think about it in a different way, and you have to plan for it.
Where do you see this heading in the future? I mean, if we did emerge from the pandemic someday when there was no concern about spreading of disease, do you think we'll return to have trials like they were before, all in person without any remote component? Or do you think there's some aspects of the remote trial process that are actually better than what we did before because they're more inclusive, more efficient, produce better results, and some of those elements may be here to stay? What do you think?
Yes, yes, and yes. There are some that say that we are now in endemic rather than pandemic. I don't know about that. I know we're all tired. And I do know that we're all looking forward to the time that we can return to that which we know. That being said, there are immense benefits from in-person trials, and we have a 200-plus year tradition, practice of in-person advocacy. And the reason why we have that is because it works. There are advantages to remote trials. There are, again, the ability of the jurors to pay greater attention, which is really underestimated at this point. It will become and is becoming more and more, we're having increasing awareness of that. But there are two factors that will ultimately drive this forward. And so, yes, we will be returning to more in-person trials. That is inevitable because that's what we know. It's what we're used to. But there's two factors that are going to drive forward the evolution of increased usage of fully virtual trials. The first, and both of these factors are, they're like the ocean. There are forces that require no force or no energy to keep going, and they're just inevitable. The first is economic. The reality is a fully remote jury trial has immense economic benefits to the parties. I've had two lawyers, again, one of whom started out being somewhat skeptical, but both of them, after having completed their trial, essentially said, we need to do this in every case. And they talked about the economic benefits to the lawyers in terms of how they prepared their case, the fact that they didn't have to travel their experts, they didn't have to travel their witnesses. They were able to get more done and to prepare better during the trial. So the economics of this, especially as it relates to business litigation, especially as it relates to clients that lawyers may have that will become more and more cost conscious, the economics will encourage the increased usage of fully virtual trials. And there's a second issue which we're experiencing here in King County, and that is cultural. And the fact that because of virtual trials, we have the increased opportunity to participate, increased opportunity. And by that, I mean not only of litigants, but also of jurors, and increased transparency. And that cultural issue, again, it doesn't require any force. It just exists. And so it is one of those things that will encourage the increased use of it. Will we go back to, and in many jurisdictions, exclusively back to fully in-person trials? Sure. Will those jurisdictions eventually evolve to a place where you can have both existing side by side? Sure. For us, virtual jury selection is, unfortunately, because of the logistics of that, we can't really do both. We can't both have people coming down for jury orientation reporting in person to be assigned out to a courtroom and to have fully virtual. We find fully virtual works, and again, economically, works much better because we never run out of jurors. We always have essentially kind of like a full jury room because we can summon a lot of people and bring them in as we need them rather than being limited to the 300 seats that we have down in the jury room. And so, you know, for us, fully virtual jury selection is really important. It's also really important during each of these processes that the lawyers become, and we're finding in our studies show that it's lawyers that have been in practice longer than 11 years. And yeah, I know that's a weird statistic, but it's longer than 11 years that are the most resistant. And that's because they're not used to it. Lawyers with less than 11 years experience find they actually can read the jurors better and they can read the witnesses better. But that's because their training in how they read body language is different than those of us that spent our lives in the well dealing with, you know, essentially arms, legs, and basically watching people walk in and out. It's a different skill set.
What about from a judicial economy perspective? Has there been an analysis done, or do you have an opinion on whether use of virtual technology will increase access to jury trials?
In terms of analysis or formal studies, I think Arizona has done some, they did some pilot programs with mock juries. In terms of experience, I mean, you know, bear in mind here in King County, we've done, boy, I think at last count, it was somewhere in excess of 375, 400 fully virtual civil jury trials. And our experience there has been very consistent. Even judges that started out going, are now in the mode of, hey, this works. In terms of economy, judicial economy, look, the initial setup is hard. It's overwhelming. But you solve the problems as you go. The initial, when we're doing the setting up the panels and walking through it, it's a very different physical process for the staff, and it requires a different staffing model. And you got to think that through before you jump into it. But once you're in the trial, and I'll give you a really good example as it relates to, again, the last fully virtual trial. A lot of times the lawyers want sidebars. Well, here in Washington State, we don't do a lot of sidebars because of open courts. And what that means is that if a lawyer has a substantive issue that they want to argue, I got to boot the jury out of the room. And that takes a minimum of 15, usually about 20 minutes. Well, in a fully virtual trial, that takes me 10 seconds. And it takes me 10 seconds to bring them back in. So the effect of that is, and Judge Peckman actually commented on this in a recent article, as did Judge Lasnik and Judge Zille, who are also federal judges. But it's also been the experience of many of the members of my bench, both because of that, but also because the lawyers tend to be more prepared. They're more focused. They have thought through their case. So the cases themselves can be conducted in less time and with more focus, because it's less of an extemporaneous charismatic exercise. It is more a thoughtful, precise explanation of the facts and the law so that the deciders, the jury, can make a decision.
We're down to our last minute or two, and this has been a fascinating conversation, Judge Williams. We really appreciate it. One final question for you. With all the trials that you've conducted over the last couple of years virtually, are you seeing any trends in terms of outcomes or differences in the substantive justice that you would attribute to the medium that's different from how cases were turning out in-person trials?
Well, I think that we have to bear in mind that we've gone through a very difficult time, the last, even pre-pandemic. And the reality is it is hard to pull aside people's frustration with pandemic, frustration with institutions, from the media that is this platform that we're using. I have seen verdicts that have, and again, I attribute this more to the lawyering and the lack of adaption, but also juror frustration with being in pandemic itself. So have I seen high verdicts? Yes. Higher than what I would have seen pre-pandemic and pre-virtual? No, I can't really say that. I've seen incredibly low verdicts. I've seen goose eggs on cases where I'm kind of scratching my head. So I think that there's this huge range. I also think it's really easy for lawyers to attribute their discomfort with the platform as the reason for the verdict. My experience would be that's not the issue. It's not the platform. Maybe pandemic-related frustration among the jurors. It may be a lack of adaptation to the platform. But I don't think it's the platform itself.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. This has really been great. I've learned a lot, and I think our listeners around the country have learned a lot too. This is something everybody's struggling to adapt to in different ways in different venues around the country. So you guys are really out in front of it, and you've been a great help to us too in Maine in helping us think through some of these issues as well. You mentioned that there's some instructional videos. Are those something that the public can access if people wanted to? How would they go about finding that?
Go to the King County website, King County Superior Court website. We have a page there that says Virtual Civil Jury Trials resource page. Click on that. There's four videos. They're each about 15, 20 minutes long, and they cover pretrial, jury selection, jury management, or kind of how the jury works. And then there's lawyers considerations. And so there are four videos that just kind of walk lawyers through, or the public through, okay, this is what this looks like.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Judge Williams.
Thank you. This was fantastic.
I really appreciate the chance to talk with you guys about this. And, you know, thanks for the good work that you're doing out there and getting the word out on so many different legal topics. Much appreciated.
Thanks.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.